All right, everybody, it's 12:59, and as the recording started, I am just going to get started here with our housekeeping. So welcome to today's training. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. This training today is scheduled for about 2 hours and is being recorded to make sure that we are able to offer it on demand for those not able to make it with us live here today. While in Zoom, you'll have access to the Q&A window where you can ask questions at any time and report any technical issues that you may have. So we will not be able to address any hand raises throughout the webinar. If you're an attendee, please use the Q&A chat to report any questions or issues that you have, and we'll help you out. There is an online feedback form available for you to complete at the end of the training to let us know how it went today. By completing this feedback form, you'll also be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you'll be able to certify that you participated today. Once you do so, the certificate will be emailed to you afterwards. So on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Soil Background and Risk Assessment. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the ITRC Soil Background and Risk Assessment Guidance Document and tools produced in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. And I have put the link to the online guidance document in the chat if anybody would like to access it and explore before, after, or during the training today. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website and feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government guarantee the material nor endorse any specific products. So on slide 4, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers here today for the SBR guidance document. All these trainers were not only volunteers on the soil background and risk assessment team, but they dedicated many hours to developing this training course and volunteering as trainers as well. So with that, I am going to hand it off to Brady Johnson to kick us off here today.
Thanks so much, Devin. I appreciate it. So I'll start with the overview and going through some of the soil background definitions for the document. I would like to also call out Chrissy Peterson, who is with us today, and will be speaking about establishing soil background, and Claudio Sorrentino, who helped draft this particular training, but also was one of the main writers on the document. So I appreciate their work on this. So getting started here, I'm gonna run through just kind of the sections that we have in the soil background document. As I said, I'll be talking over the first two sections, the introduction and the soil background definition. So this whole document is a web-based guidance. I believe there is that link in the chat. We can go and want to kind of state from the start that, you know, while there are already many guidance documents that do exist covering these topics, there's not a singular document that, say, provides just comprehensive and widely accepted guidance on the state of the science for this. So this document really seeks to kind of fill that gap and provide a consensus-based, comprehensive, and defensible framework for really establishing soil background and its use in risk assessment. So I'll be going over the first two sections. The third section is going to be establishing soil background, which will be covered by Chrissy today. Section four will be the use of that soil background in risk assessment, which will be done by Bonnie, who's on the call. Sections five and six are going to go over geochemical evaluations. It's going to be really looking at different elemental ratios to assess background areas and explore possible contaminations. Karen will be going over that today. Section seven is kind of similar on those lines, but using a little bit different types of data to determine, in our case here today, if organics are representative, different organic constituents, representative of background or site contamination. And Charlie will be covering that. For the second half of our guidance, we have section eight here, which is the conceptual site model and data quality objectives. So here is really how that conceptual site model, why it's important and how it factors into our determination and characterization of background. Section nine goes into sampling. Here we really mean looking at different areas, how to define those areas, looking at the impacts of depth for your samples or perhaps sample size, talking about methodology as far as maybe composites or incremental sampling that some of you may have heard, really kind of how that plays into the comparability of data. Section 10, talking about methods, but looking at analytical methods, you know, making sure that with whatever you collect, that the lab can meet the needs of whatever you're trying to do with these soil data, be that comparing to existing data and making sure you have the right methods. I will call out, there's an excellent table. It's 10.1 in the guidance document. Has a large summary of the different types of methods, kind of some guidance or suggestions on when they should be used. Really good resource. Section 11, we move into statistics. It's really a guide that's going to be helping you choose the appropriate approach and the appropriate methods. Again, there's a table in there, 11.3, that kind of runs down different background threshold values or BTVs and helps you choose the correct methodology. We'll say briefly just these sections, 8 through 11, they're not meant to be a comprehensive study as a statistics textbook, but really help you understand the different types of statistics available and how they apply to soil backgrounds. So while there is a lot of good detail in there, it's certainly not a college level course on statistics or listing every analytical method in there. Moving on, we have section 12, which is the regulatory framework. Also, what we have is a state survey. So part of this comprehensive process was reaching out to state stakeholders and determining what exists there. From this, we have a good idea of different states and what their regulations are, particularly with different types of backgrounds. And we'll give you a little quiz later to see how you guys, this audience, compares to what we found in that survey. Section 13 does list the existing guidance and studies for the state. There's also an excellent Excel spreadsheet in there that contains all of these, lists what's in there and isn't. Again, an excellent resource. Section 14 gets into some case studies. We have case studies about establishing background soil values, some geochemical evaluations, environmental forensics with PAHs, good applications of everything we talk about. And one last kind of call out to the guidance as a whole. We do have some flowcharts in there, which are great if you're a visual learner, get you the idea of establishing soil background values, both like site-specific and default background, and also how to use soil background. So a lot of good information in those. Real briefly, I want to talk about the limitations of the SBR guidance. It does not provide specific background values for individual chemicals. We're not going to have a table that says you should expect to find no more than 5 ppb of something in there. It does not replace existing regulatory guidance. I think that's very important. We are trying to support risk-based decision-making and complement existing guidance that may be in your state, in your region. So always check with your oversight agency. Unless it does not provide in-depth details on sampling and lab analytical methods, statistics. Again, we provide some guidance in what you should be looking for and perhaps different methods that would apply, but it's not comprehensive in that nature. Along with our online text guidance, we've also developed training videos. So this is a series of 4 videos, about 20 minutes apiece, that walk through the primary points of each topic and include some links to the written documents. These are the introduction. We have one on sampling and analytical methods, default and site-specific background, and geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics. So we'll make sure to get I see Devin's posted the link in there, so thank you. Yeah, excellent videos, walks through some of the same figures here today and a lot of the same voices if you want to come back and listen to us talk on your own time. So today, training topics, kind of went over these a little bit. Went over the introduction. I'm going to walk through some of the definitions that we have developed as a group with soil background. We'll get into establishing soil background, as I said, with Chrissy, Bonnie with using soil background and risk assessment. Karen will go over the geochemical evaluations, and Charlie will wrap everything up with the environmental forensics. So the definitions, we kind of have these in paired as far as natural soil background and anthropogenic ambient soil background, comparing default soil and site-specific soil background, and also the soil background reference area. I do just kind of want to point out here that with these, you know, these definitions were developed for purposes of this guidance document. We need this shared framework to be able to discuss these topics and have a broad consensus on how these particular, you know, concepts are defined. So they could be, you know, slightly different in other regulatory agencies or entities that you work with, but here they're intended to provide context to inform and, you know, support this discussion. So the first one we'll talk about is natural soil background. That is the amount of substance or family of closely related substances present in soil due to geologic characteristics, natural processes, or releases from non-anthropogenic sources like forest fires, which is a key point in that. So here, kind of some figures. These are also taken from the videos. You can see these animated on YouTube. But for our natural soil background, we can have a site here on your left where you have naturally occurring arsenic in the soils. Arsenic naturally occurring from rock weathering. Those are in the green icons. Someplace like in Idaho where I'm at, primarily from sulfide minerals or clays. And then on the right, we can have contamination from arsenic. So here, looking at a farmer spraying his apple orchards with a lead arsenate pesticide or herbicide, contributing additional arsenic contamination, here shown by the orange. So depending on your project, it may be important to understand how much of that arsenic concentration that you're measuring in soil is from background in the green compared to what's being applied in the orange from your specific site activities. Our next definition that we have is anthropogenic ambient backgrounds, and this is the amount of a substance or family of closely related substances present in the soil due to anthropogenic non-point sources or due to their ability to be transported long distances. So for this, what we're really thinking and what and when we're trying to establish this, we should really consider the intended purpose and clearly define what is anthropogenic and ambient and what should be included in a risk assessment. So here we have these blue icons, the PAHs, that are anthropogenic ambient, expected to be in soil from this area, from this region, but not directly from this particular site. So in here, the orange factor, the orange clouds are specific to the factory. So as we're looking at background, we have these two components, the anthropogenic ambient in the blue, widespread, and then the orange, which is our localized contamination. Moving on from that, we have default soil backgrounds. So the default soil background, typically established by regulatory agencies for a larger area, be that a state, a region, have a unique geologic area, say like a mining area or mineralized zone, that generally share the same physical, chemical, geological, and biological characteristics. This, we generally think it to be as conservative just because it's intended to be used for a large number of sites, something that works for a broad area like a state. And the default soil background can be established for both natural and anthropogenic ambient soil background concentrations, our two previous definitions. Our other type of background here is we have site-specific soil background. So this is generally established by a responsible party for an area of limited geographic scope that represents one specific site. We have an incinerator cleanup, a railroad. This is your site-specific background, really what you're studying in that. Compared to the conservatism, another one, this is generally thought to be a more accurate way to evaluate whether a site chemical concentrations are representative background, because it's relevant to a specific site in a specific area that you've defined or the responsible party has defined. Similar to default background, this can be established for both natural and anthropogenic ambient soil background. And the last definition that I wanted to cover for our discussion today is soil background reference area. So these are areas identified as appropriate for a collection of samples used to ultimately determine a soil background concentration or a range of concentrations and can be used in ecological risk assessment. Two kind of important points here as far as for choosing a background reference area starts with your conceptual site model. You know, this provides the context as far as land use or maybe geochemical or other chemical considerations that provides the basis for selecting your background reference areas. And they should reflect areas without site releases. That means they should be in a similar location, considering physical, geological, and biological characteristics. It can also be an ecological risk assessment. If we kind of move over to where you would want to evaluate your impact on the community composition for those specific constituents of potential concern, the COPCs here. So with those definitions out, I want to have a poll question here. We can kind of do, but does the state regulatory agency you work either for or work with most, do they have a definition of natural and or anthropogenic ambient soil background? So your question here, you should have yes for both natural and anthropogenic ambient, yes for natural only, or no. kind of give a little time for this and see how it compares to what we found in our other survey. I will say our original survey, I believe we had 36 states in DC, maybe 37. So we had a pretty good, hopefully a pretty good sample. So I think we can maybe like 10 more seconds and wrap this up. We're right there. Okay. So let's see where we got. We have 31% for natural and anthropogenic, 42% for natural only, and 27% for no. So yeah, that's great. That matches pretty closely to what we found, I think overall, so we have, 73% that have some definition here. Our survey reported, I believe, 61. So we either have a very knowledgeable group of people on this call that are well tied into their state's guidance documents, or we could be biased in those particular states. But that's very interesting. Only 27% now. That's good. Well, thank you all much. That's the start of it. And we can kick this on over to Chrissy.
Okay, so thanks, Brady. I am an human health risk assessor with EHS Support. And again, I'm Chrissy Peterson. And today I'm going to cover establishing soil background. Just to make sure, All right. Okay. So let's just go back to that apple orchard with the naturally occurring arsenic that Brady used to help explain definitions. And our farmer here sprayed an arsenical pesticide, and it looks like that storage container also had some releases. So, you know, the question is, how do you determine whether arsenic in your soil samples is a result of the naturally occurring arsenic in your soil, or is it contamination from the historical operations? So to do that, that's where you need to establish your soil background condition for that determination. In the guidance document, two frameworks are presented that depict the processes for establishing soil background. One discusses default soil background and one presents site-specific soil background. And this is framework one, which presents the process for establishing default soil background. And we'll go ahead and step through this first. So when you're establishing default soil background, you will be developing background threshold values, or BTVs, for use in the screening risk assessment. And to do this, you first need to determine whether you should conduct a soil study or if you should use an existing soil study. So while you can use an existing soil study, conducting a background study is the preferred approach to establishing background. Planning is key to achieve project goals and data quality objectives whether you are conducting the soil background study or using an established one. So sections 3.2 and 3.6 of the SBR guidance provide important considerations for either conducting a background study or using an established background study. For example, when you're conducting a background study, it's important to think through whether you're evaluating natural or anthropogenic ambient background or both, and also, as we discussed, how those are defined by the agency that you're working with, because they can differ. For an established soil background study, understanding the purpose and intended use of that study is also important, as well as how that would compare to your purpose. And then, as Brady mentioned, Table 13.2 of the guidance presents a list of existing soil background studies that were available and identified when the guidance was developed. It's not an exhaustive list of what's out there, but it does include federal, state, international, academic, as well as some private sector studies. So that could be a resource for you. So based on review, decided that we need to conduct a background study because the established study is just not going to work. So the first step is to define the study area. And when you're choosing the soil background reference area, it's important to understand whether you're evaluating natural or anthropogenic ambient background. You need to ensure your background reference area has similar characteristics to the site or sites that you'll be comparing the study to. Additionally, you want background reference area to be upgradient or upwind of the investigation site to ensure that it was not affected by contaminants from any past or present releases or activities that are being investigated at the site. Once you've identified a location as your background reference area, you'll need to clearly document your rationale for selection of this area. In section 3.3, you can refer to that for more discussion on selection of the soil background reference areas. Okay, so now we have the background study area selected, and the next step is sampling. These are some additional things to consider as part of your sample design. Each topic is covered in detail in section 9 of the guidance document. However, we don't have time really to go into detail today, so definitely refer to these sections. And as you're doing so, remember you want your background samples to be as similar to the site samples in terms of depth, size, sampling methods, sampling design, sample collection methods as possible. All right, so we've got our samples collected. And now we can discuss laboratory analysis. And just to note on the flowchart here, the laboratory analysis follows after sampling. However, this should be determined before your sampling activities to make sure that you have your correct sampling methods identified, have the correct bottleware, and you understand your hold times for the different types of analyses. As with sampling, as we discussed, consistency between the background study and the site is key for laboratory analysis also. Although it is best to use the same lab to analyze samples from a background study and a site, this is not generally attainable with a default background due to the large number of sites that will be evaluated using a BTV. At a minimum, you'll need to verify that the lab has the appropriate accreditation and certifications for the analyses that are being performed. And section 10 of the guidance discusses data quality considerations, analytical limits, preparation and digestion, as well as analytical test methods. So it is important when you're selecting laboratory analysis of samples to keep the following things in mind. We have the Quality Assurance Project Plan, or QAP, and data quality objectives that are outlined therein. Sensitivity of the analytical methods and whether your reporting limits will be low enough to detect and quantify the analytes of interest, as well as minimizing to the extent possible the left censoring of your data set. Differences between sample preparation and digestion methods and implications for comparing data sets are important, and I'll discuss that in a little further detail in the following slide. So the guidance, as Brady noted, provides an example of analytical test methods for common metals and various organic analyte groups. And this is just a preview of that table from the guidance. And it has a brief synopsis of the method and discusses whether the analytical method is suitable for use in the soil background studies. And then other things to keep in mind are whether you will need additional data for geochemical evaluations or environmental forensics. And section 10 of the guidance discusses each of these topics in detail. And then Karen and Charlie will discuss the geochemical and environmental forensics in a little bit. So as I noted, one important thing to understand is the differences between the sample prep methods because different preparation methods can produce very different results. An example of the importance of using similar preparation and analytical methods is presented in section 10.4. This discusses the differences in digestion methods for metals between a USGS method and a USEPA method. The USGS method and USEPA methods have different preparation methods for metals analyses because the goal of these two methods are different. And for the USGS method, the digestion method is for total metals, which results in liberating more metals off the soil matrix than the USEPA method, which is appropriate for environmentally available metals. So therefore, in most cases, the USGS method would result in higher concentrations than the USEPA's preparation method, which uses a different and less harsh digestive method. For risk assessment purposes, generally the environmentally available concentrations of metals are what should be quantified. And table 10.1 here also presents a summary of different soil sample preparation methods. It also includes whether or not the method is suitable for soil background studies and the rationale for that determination. Okay, so now that the results are back from the lab, we'll need to perform some data analysis on the data set, as well as establishing a soil background threshold value for each of your chemicals. So let's just take a minute to discuss what we're establishing for default background, and that's called the background threshold value, or BTV. And what is the BTV? The background threshold value is an upper bound comparison value generated from either a default or site-specific background data set. And this value will then be compared to a representative site concentration, which we'll discuss more in the next section. Multiple statistical methods are available to calculate BTVs. So therefore, statistical expertise is recommended when you calculate the BTV. You need to understand things like the distribution of your data set, how to determine how you're handling your non-detects. A graphical presentation of the data set is needed, and that will help you identify and remove potential outliers from your data set. And all of these sections listed here provide additional information on these topics. So in addition to understanding the points we just discussed, you should also understand the differences between different statistical values used to represent BTVs and their advantages and disadvantages. So section 11.7 and Appendix A specifically of the guidance provide description of the various types of statistical values that may be used for the BTVs. And table 11.3 is a summary of the values that might be used. And situations that may result in false positives or potentially falsely declaring a site clean, or the alternative of false negatives, which are falsely declaring a site clean, and then the alternative, which would be false positives, which would be falsely declaring a site contaminated, are also discussed in these sections. Okay, so just comparing here the different statistical values that could be used for the default BTVs. The upper percentile and upper prediction limits have high false positive rates when a large number of comparisons are made. So they're generally not used for default BTVs. The UCL of the mean is not generally used because it represents the upper bound of the mean or central tendency, and the BTV is the upper threshold of the representative background population. So therefore, using the UCL of the mean would also result in excessive false positives. The upper simultaneous limit has high false negative rates because it is an upper limit of a maximum value. And the upper tolerance limit is appropriate to use when we have a large number of comparisons that are made, and it is most often used to establish BTVs. With the 95-95 UTL, the common measure of the BTV. Okay, so now we've briefly gone through the first framework for establishing default background. So let's discuss how to establish site-specific background, which is displayed here in framework two. So the good news is, as you can probably see, there are a lot of similarities between their two, framework one and framework two. Just a few differences here to highlight. So if you're conducting a study or you're using an existing study, the study should be similar to specific site characteristics rather than the multiple sites in the default framework. And then as with default background, when you establish site-specific soil background, you're also going to develop a site-specific BTV. However, you are also going to use the site-specific background data set in its entirety to compare to your site data set. So here we have a little discussion on comparing a site-specific soil background data set to a site concentration data set. And that compares the central tendency of both data sets. So it allows you to determine if there is a slight but pervasive contamination at your site. And then while comparing a site data to a site-specific BTV addresses the question of whether the maximum concentrations are within the range of site-specific background. And section 11.8 of the guidance discusses different statistical tests that may be used to compare the two data sets. And table 11.5, it's a little small here, it's bigger on the online guidance, presents a summary of these with advantages and disadvantages of the tests. So BTVs, whether they are default or site-specific, are established in the same manner. The difference is that the site-specific BTV is established using a data set that is more similar to your site than the data set used to establish a default BTV. And what that means is a site-specific BTV is a refinement from using the default BTVs, as it will more closely match the background of the site that you're evaluating. And remember that the BTV is the upper end estimate that is used to tell you whether your maximum concentrations are within the range of background. And the UTL is the most commonly used for site-specific BTV as well as the default BTV. But it could be appropriate to use one of the other values depending on your site-specific situation. So it's definitely important to have someone with statistical experience and expertise to help you determine the BTV. Okay, so now we've come to our poll question here. And the question is it appropriate to use the UCL of the mean as the BTV? And you can either select yes or no. And so let that run for a little bit. So Devin, I'll let you decide when we have a good spectrum of responses here. Okay, so we had 24% with yes, and then 76% weighing in as no. And the correct answer is no, that you should use an upper end estimate such as the UTL, USL, UPL, or even sometimes the upper percentile for a BTV. Because remember, the BTV is the upper bound estimate, while the UCL of the mean is more of a central tendency representation. So that is a common term used in risk assessment. So it's important to just note that when establishing BTV, you're not using the UCL of the mean. Okay, so I think with that, I'm going to pass it over to Bonnie.
Hey everybody, I'm Bonnie. I'm a toxicologist at the Washington Department of Ecology. And today I'm going to talk about using soil background in risk assessment. There we go. Sorry about that. I was having a little trouble getting the slides to advance, but I think I have it now. So today I'm going to talk about default soil background and risk assessment, site-specific soil background and risk assessment, and then I'm just going to touch on remedial goals. So just a little bit about that in the guidance. One really important thing before we get started is to make sure that you coordinate with your regulatory agency. Each regulatory agency has their own definition of background and requirements that may differ significantly from what we have in the guidance. For the guidance, we had to come up with something that was generally used by most states and use that to teach, to inform people of what the general process is. But that doesn't mean that that's the only process you can follow. It doesn't mean that that's the only correct process. So it's very important that you coordinate with that regulatory agency that you're going to work with. Chrissy showed us two frameworks. We had framework one, how to establish default soil background. Framework two, how to establish site-specific soil background. And this is framework three. Framework three is how to use soil background and risk assessment. So I'm going to use this framework to explain how we do that. Geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics, that is on the left side of the screen, is very important, and it can actually be used in any part of the process, not just the site-specific risk assessment, but it's usually used in the site-specific risk assessment. So it's very important, and it's a tool that's underutilized, but I am not going to talk about it. Karen and Charlie, we have a whole presentation that Karen and Charlie are going to talk about each devoted to it. It's so important. So don't take it that I'm crossing it out, but it's not important. It's just that I'm going to save some space on my slides and not include that. The first thing that we need to do is to determine what that representative site concentration is. And that's how we refer to it in the guidance, a representative site concentration. It's really just the site concentration that you compare to the background threshold value, or BTV. That's usually going to be the maximum. That's most common, but it could also be the 95th percentile. If you are using a USL as your BTV, that upper simultaneous limit, then you do need to use a maximum to compare to it, because the USL is an upper boundary on the data set maximum. So you wouldn't want to use anything but a maximum, or you wouldn't be being protective enough. Some other times that you want to use a maximum are when your sample size is inadequate and when there's a lot of variability in your site data, which is very common on cleanup sites. So that's why the maximum is the most commonly used. It can be okay to use a 95th percentile, but never when you have the UCL as your BTB. It's appropriate when you have a BTB that was calculated using a similar statistic. And it's also appropriate when you have a really large data set that your positive represents a single population. It's important when comparing the site concentration to the background threshold value to use a similar statistics. One example would be a 95th percentile site concentration compared to a 95-95 UTL BTV. It's not appropriate to compare a 95 UCL of the mean site concentration, which a lot of us use as an exposure concentration on cleanup sites, to a BTV, because that 95 UCL of the mean is an average and that BTV is an upper end estimate. You probably remember this framework from Chrissy's presentation. It's establishing default soil background. And I have that as a reminder because I wanted you to remember that when you do that, you end up with a default BTV. And so that's what you're going to use in your screening risk assessment. In your screening risk assessment, you're going to take that site concentration that you determined, and you're going to compare it to your risk-based soil screening value first. If the site concentration exceeds the risk-based soil screening value, that's when you're going to move into your background. I apologize, I'm having a little bit of allergies today. If your site concentration does not exceed, you don't have to do anything further. Now, if you don't have a default BTV for your chemical, that's the time when you're going to have to move straight into the site-specific risk assessment that we're going to talk about in just a couple of slides. When you're looking at your site concentration and you're comparing it to your default BTV, generally that site concentration is going to be a maximum, but it could be a 95th percentile. So you're going to do that on a point-by-point basis. And what that means is you're going to take each discrete soil sample and you're going to compare it to the BTV and see which soil samples exceed, which don't. The reason you're going to do that is because you can better characterize your site that way. It's better to know if you have 1 exceedance out of 10 or if you have 9 exceedances out of 10. It tells a different story about the site. And it can also give you an idea of what areas of the site are an issue and what maybe aren't. If your site concentrations are less than or equal to your default BTV, then no further action is necessary. If your site concentrations are greater than your default BTV, then you can move on to the test for proportions. The test for proportions is in US EPA's ProUCL software. It's also, you can use any software you want, but EPA's ProUCL software is most often used by agencies, state agencies, and federal agencies because it's not only free, but it's really user-friendly. And so at a lot of state agencies, we don't have a huge statistical staff that we can go and talk to and have work on our sites. So a lot of us have to use our own knowledge about statistics, and we can maybe talk to people in the EPA or our other agencies, but we really need to be able to understand how to use the software. So that's why we most commonly use ProUCL. The test for proportions asks the question of, is the rate of exceedances of the default BTV, so we're looking at the site concentration compared to the default BTV, significantly different than zero? If the answer to that is no, then the data set, we are going to assume the data set represents background, and we don't need to do anything further. If the answer to that question is yes, we assume the data set does not represent background, and then we need to move on to the site-specific risk assessment. And here is framework 2 for establishing site-specific soil background. And the reason I put that up there is because I wanted you all to remember that we have 2 tools we can use when we're looking at a site-specific situation. We can use the site-specific background data set, and we can also use a site-specific BTV. I'm just going to take a quick drink real quick. All right. Sorry, everybody, about that. Next up, and I am not able to move these slides. Here we go. There's just a little bit of... All right. Okay. A little bit of wait time between. So these 2 are complementary tests. Both should be performed using the site concentration, comparing it to the site-specific soil BTV, and comparing the site concentration to the site-specific soil background data set. They test for the presence of different types of contamination. When you're looking at site concentrations and comparing them to a site-specific BTV, you're looking in an upper-end comparison. You're asking yourself, are site concentrations within the distribution of soil background? Is there localized contamination? When you're taking the site-specific data set and you're comparing it to the site-specific soil background data set, that's a central tendency comparison. And you're asking, is there slight but pervasive contamination? We're getting into a little bit more detail about comparing that site concentration to that site-specific BTV. First, you need to get that site concentration, which is generally going to be your maximum, but could be your 95th percentile. Remember, you're going to do that on a point-by-point basis. It's very similar to default. You're going to take each discrete soil sample concentration and compare it to the site-specific BTV. If your site concentrations are less than or equal to your site-specific BTV, then you would move on. This is where it differs a little. You would move on and compare your site data set to your site-specific soil background data set. If your site concentrations are greater than your site-specific BTV, that's when you'd move on to the test for proportions. And same thing, the test for proportions is in the ProUCL software, but you can use whatever software you want as long as your regulatory agency is okay with that. It tests for, are the rate of exceedances above the site-specific BTV significantly different than zero? If the answer to that is no, then we assume that the data set represents background. Then we move on to compare the site data set to the site-specific soil background data set. If the answer to that is yes, we assume the data set does not represent background. And then that's when we can move on to geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics. Again, they can be used anywhere in the process, but this is just kind of typically the way that it goes. Now we're going to talk about comparing the site data set to the site-specific background data set. So there's that other tool that we need to use. One thing you're going to want to do is compare the different data set distributions. So you're going to need to compare the site data set distribution to the site-specific background distribution. And we don't have time to talk over every little thing today, but I'm going to tell you where you can find this in the guidance. Table 11-1 contains some common distributions for environmental data. Something else that you're going to need to do is compare the data sets using graphical plots. And you can compare them using a quantile plot or a QQ plot, using a histogram, a box plot, a percentile plot, or a probability plot. Another thing you're going to need to do is look for outliers. This is very important. So if you're not paying attention, this might be something you want to pay attention to. Table 11-2 gives you a list of outlier tests. It gives you the assumptions, the advantages, and the disadvantages. But what's really important about this is just because you do an outlier test on your data and you get a result and it says this is a potential outlier, and I want to emphasize potential outlier, doesn't mean it's an outlier. We already know, especially with small data sets, which we usually have, that the concentrations may vary quite a bit, especially for natural background and soil. And so what you need to do is you need to look back at your sampling, you need to look back at your QA, QC if you're analytical, and you need to find something, some rationale that supports you removing that as an outlier. You need to talk it over with your project team, and you need to come up with some rationale, not just based on that one test, you know, something else, before you just decide to remove this outlier. Because it may not be an outlier. You also need to figure out how to handle your non-detects. And section 11.3 of the guidance gives you some methods that you can use, like substitution, the Kaplan-Meier method, regression on order statistics, and maximum likelihood estimate. What method you decide to use is really going to depend on your situation and also what your regulatory agency allows you to use. And lastly, you are going to need to pick an appropriate two-sample hypothesis test to actually compare your site data set to your site-specific background data set. This is absolutely, hands down, my favorite table in the guidance, table 11-5. I wish I would have had this a long time ago. It gives you the test, the objective and assumptions, the advantages and the disadvantages. It is just an awesome table and is very helpful. Once you're done with all of this, if your site concentrations are less than or equal to your site-specific BTV and your site-specific data set, and there's no further action needed. If your site concentration is greater than your site-specific BTV or, and I emphasize or, your site-specific data set, then that's when you're going to want to move into your geochemical evaluation and or your environmental forensics, just depending on what contaminants you have. And Charlie and Karen are going to talk about that next. I'm just going to touch on remedial goals real quick, and then we're going to have another poll question. And if you end up with your site concentrations not being representative of soil background, then you can use soil background when you're setting remedial goals. You can do this in two ways. You can use a site-specific BTV to be your remedial goal. I mean, there's probably other ways too, but these are the ways that we have in the guidance. And you could also compare the site data set and the site-specific soil background data set just to figure out areas that may need some type of remediation. And that is concluding my presentation. And we have a poll question. It's a two-part poll question. So if you can answer both, that'd be awesome. The first question is, what site concentration is most often used to compare to a BTV? Most often used is emphasized. And there's only one answer. And then the second question is, if the BTV you are using to compare two site concentrations is a USL and upper simultaneous limit, what site concentration is appropriate to use? And again, there's only one. And we'll just give it a couple seconds or a few seconds or half a minute or however long Devin's going to take. And then we'll see what the results are.
Bonnie, I'm going to give it a minute or so here just because it is a two-part question.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, and I'm kind of disappointed that we can't vote as panelists.
All right, everybody, just 10 more seconds and then I'll close the poll.
All right, it looks like most of you got it right. It is maximum for both of the questions. You need to use the maximum if you have a BTV that's an upper simultaneous limit, because that is based on the maximum of the data set. And generally we use the maximum just because generally we don't have a whole lot of data and there's a lot of variability in our data for cleanup sites. And I am finished, so I am gonna turn it over to Karen. Looks like we're a little bit ahead. So if we do have extra time at the end, we can just have more time for Q&A.
Okay, thank you, Bonnie. I'm Karen Thorbjørnsen. I'm a senior geochemist with APTEM, and I'm going to talk about geochemical valuations of metals. Geochemical valuation is a technique based on selected elemental ratios, and we use it to identify the processes controlling element concentrations in soil and to confirm or rule out the presence of contamination in individual samples. These ratios reflect the affinities that trace elements have to adsorb on the surfaces of specific minerals in soil. An anomalous ratio might indicate the presence of an excess trace element from a contaminant source. And I should add that elemental ratios have been used for many decades as a geochemical prospecting technique in the mining industry. These evaluations have many applications, but they're important during background studies, where our goal is to characterize representative background concentrations and conditions. And we also need to keep in mind that all available field observations and analytical data are considered during geochemical evaluations of metals. Specialized analytical data aren't required, just standard analyses of elements in discrete soil samples. And a few other things to note, geochemical evaluation is not a statistical technique. Instead, it complements statistics by evaluating analytical results from a different perspective. And we're going to discuss a simple example evaluation today, but not all evaluations will be this simple. We should keep in mind that geochemical evaluations should be performed by experienced geochemists because many potential geochemical processes need to be considered when evaluating soil data sets. And if you're curious about the aluminum versus iron correlation plot on the screen here, that can be found and is explained in section 14. It's one of the case studies. We don't have time for it today. And there we go. This is the framework that Bonnie discussed earlier. Geochemical evaluations can be used as an additional line of evidence during risk assessment. Sometimes they aren't used until the end of the process, but they can and should be used throughout the entire process. Section 5 in the guidance describes what geochemical evaluations are, some of the science behind them, a few simple examples, and how to apply the results during background studies. Section 14 provides some insightful case studies using real-world data sets. They demonstrate how the evaluations can guide the treatment of individual metals concentrations during a background study. The case study of section 14.4 gives you an example of how a high vanadium concentration that was flagged as a statistical outlier was determined to just be a naturally elevated concentration that should remain in the candidate background data set. Retaining that vanadium concentration resulted in a more representative background data set because excluding it would have biased the background summary statistics and background screening value toward lower and unrepresentative values. In contrast to that, section 14.5 describes a case study where geochemical evaluation confirmed the results of a statistical outlier test. An elevated arsenic concentration that was shown to be a statistical outlier was determined geochemically to not be representative of background conditions. So the statistics and the geochemistry agreed. So in that case, it was appropriate to remove the elevated arsenic concentration because it represented potential contamination. And that way, the background data set wasn't biased high. And section 14.6 illustrates a candidate background data set for which the statistical outlier test didn't identify any outliers, but geochemical evaluation indicated that the sample with the maximum lead concentration was potentially impacted by lead contamination. That lead concentration was then removed, resulting in a more representative background data set. Section 5.2 of the guidance describes the various purposes for which geochemical evaluations are used, such as determining whether statistical outliers should be retained or determining whether subgroups of background data can be combined. Another primary purpose is to identify the geochemical processes controlling element concentrations in soil. And shown here are the geochemical mechanisms to consider when evaluating your soil data. These are not all going to be taking place at your site, but they're worth considering, and certainly the multiple ones might be present. And typically the most important control is adsorption-desorption reactions on mineral surfaces in soil. And we examined those relationships using scatter plots and ratio plots. And while the data are visualized graphically, the evaluation is not just a graphical technique. For example, be sure to study your field observations, such as soil descriptions from sample collection logs, drilling logs, site photographs. All these sources of information can provide additional lines of evidence to support conclusions based on elemental ratios. And shown here are a few common elemental associations, but this list is not complete and nor is it prescriptive. Section 5 provides many references that should be consulted for detailed discussions of geochemical mechanisms. The terms clays, iron oxides, and manganese oxides are umbrella terms for large classes of fine-grained minerals that are common in soil. Trace elements have affinities to adsorb on these soil-forming minerals, which are represented by the major elements shown here, aluminum, iron, manganese. These adsorption affinities manifest as consistent trace versus major element ratios in a set of uncontaminated soil samples. Samples with excess trace element from a contaminant source are identified by their anomalously high elemental ratios. So, for example, when we receive lab analyses for our soil samples, the reported aluminum concentrations reflect the amount of clay minerals in soil. Remember that all clay minerals contain aluminum as a primary component. And these minerals tend to maintain net negative surface charges under circumneutral pH conditions. So they have they attract the cationic species listed here, barium, cadmium, and zinc, among others. So if you need to evaluate barium, then you can evaluate it by plotting barium concentrations versus the corresponding aluminum concentrations in a set of samples. All iron oxides contain iron as a primary component, and they tend to maintain net positive surface charges under circumneutral pH and oxidizing redox conditions. So they attract oxyanionic species containing arsenic or vanadium, among other elements. So you'd examine those trace elements by plotting their concentrations versus iron, the corresponding iron concentrations in your soil samples. And all manganese oxides contain manganese as a primary component. Manganese oxide minerals may be present in oxic soils, and they have strong affinities to adsorb specific trace elements such as cobalt and lead and barium as well. Now, here's a simple, very simple example of an evaluation and how the results were used. There was a background study that was performed at a facility where the candidate background data set included 61 surface soil samples and 277 subsurface soil samples, which is a very large background data set. The project team wondered if these data could be pooled because during subsequent site investigations, the risk assessors would evaluate hypothetical receptors exposure to total or surface and subsurface soil. Also of interest was the highest cobalt concentration of 394 milligrams per kilogram, which was identified as a statistical outlier for the subsurface soil data set. Should it be removed or retained? So geochemical evaluation was conducted to determine whether this outlier cobalt concentration had a natural source and was really part of the background population. Soils in this area where this background study was performed contain lots of naturally occurring manganese oxide minerals. And again, these oxides have strong affinities to adsorb specific trace elements such as cobalt and barium. So this is a scatter plot of the data. Surface soil samples are depicted as green circles, subsurface soil samples depicted as orange circles. This should say cobalt along the y-axis. And the cobalt concentrations are plotted along the y-axis, and the corresponding manganese concentrations are plotted along the x-axis. And we see here that the cobalt concentrations are generally proportional to the corresponding manganese concentrations in the samples. All of the samples form a common trend with a positive slope. Samples with the highest cobalt also have the highest manganese. And the sample with the highest cobalt has the highest manganese concentration of all, and it lies along this trend established by the other samples. This is the so-called statistical outlier concentration. And it's easier to tell if this sample with the highest cobalt has a cobalt manganese ratio that's similar to those of the other samples by actually calculating the ratios, easily done in Excel, and then preparing a ratio plot. So again, here the y-axis depicts cobalt concentrations, which is not showing up well on screen. And then the x-axis depicts the cobalt versus manganese ratios here instead of the manganese concentrations. And this ratio plot also lets us compare the surface ratios to the subsurface ratios. So we can see here that the ratios are similar. Also of note is that they span a very narrow range, just slightly more than an order of magnitude. If a sample had cobalt contamination, then it would lie above the trend, this trend over here in the correlation plot, the scatter plot, and it would lie to the right of the other samples in the ratio plot. But we don't observe that. And the sample with the statistical outlier cobalt concentration has a cobalt manganese ratio that lies within that ratio range established by the other samples. So this sample is naturally enriched in manganese oxide minerals and associated trace elements like cobalt. The elevated cobalt concentration was therefore retained in the background data set because it's most likely natural. If other trace elements also exhibit similarity in elemental ratios, regardless of depth, then that suggests that there's no need to keep the surface and subsurface soil data separate all of the time. So for this facility, after evaluating many other elements in soil, the project team decided that it was appropriate to combine the surface and subsurface soil background data sets in addition to having separate data sets. Summary statistics and inferential statistics were then calculated for the three background data sets. Geochemical evaluation of site data is typically performed after an initial screening for COPCs, such as comparison of site data to risk-based screening values, or comparison to the higher of the risk-based screening value or background value. This is because site concentrations below screening values wouldn't typically warrant a geochemical evaluation. So chemicals with site concentrations that exceed their screening values are then included in a geochemical evaluation. If the evaluation indicates that an element site concentrations are consistent with background conditions, what is sometimes called background related, then that element doesn't need to be evaluated further in the risk assessment, even if the concentrations exceed risk-based screening values. Alternatively, the results of geochemical evaluation can be used during the risk characterization stage. And the goal here is to determine whether element-related risks can be attributed to site impacts or represent naturally occurring or anthropogenic ambient conditions. This evaluation would likely occur as a refinement step, a refinement step following the initial presentation of risk estimates. And when should geochemical evaluations and environmental forensics for organics be considered during your project? The guidance emphasizes early in the project life cycle because these data evaluation techniques require specific sampling methods and specific lab analyses. And again, in the case of geochemical evaluations of metals, these aren't sophisticated analyses, they're standard, but you do need to analyze for major elements, including aluminum, calcium, iron, magnesium, manganese, along with the trace elements of concern or interest for your site. And depending on your site, other reference elements can include potassium and sodium, and perhaps others. And so here is a quiz question for you. You may have seen these in an earlier slide. Which are potential geochemical mechanisms controlling element concentrations in soil? Select any and all that apply. And Devin, I'll leave it up to you to decide when to close the poll.
About 30 more seconds, and then I'll close the poll.
All right. Okay. I'm very impressed everybody got the main point, which is that adsorption on clays, iron oxides, and manganese oxides are extremely important in weathered soils. That is the dominant mechanism, honestly. But it's a trick question because they actually all apply. They can apply, not all at your site, depending on where you are in terms of geology and climate. One or more of these may apply. So the answer is technically these can all be considered. But yes, adsorption is the dominant mechanism. Section 5.5.4 of the guidance provides some literature references to read for more information. And again, I want to emphasize that geochemical evaluation isn't simply a graphical approach. You do need to consider all available data and information when you're drawing conclusions. And we recommend that an experienced geochemist perform the evaluation because these evaluations can get quite complex. And with that, I will hand it off to Charlie, who's going to give an awesome discussion on environmental forensics for organic compounds.
Okay, thank you, Karen. So I am Charlie DeWolf, and I'm an ecological and human health risk assessor and a geochemist, and I will provide a brief overview of the environmental forensics portion of the guidance. So we've seen this framework before. And as Karen just said, with respect to geochemical evaluations, you should consider environmental forensics as part of your initial scoping and CSM development. You should think about background sources, the need for forensics, for sample analyses that you would need to support forensics, and how environmental forensics might come into play in your site risk assessment. Typically, however, the actual environmental forensics evaluation becomes important and would come into play in this site-specific phase of a risk assessment at the bottom of this blue box here. So the moral of the story is to plan ahead. Here is a definition of environmental forensics given in the glossary in the guidance. It's a very broad definition, and indeed, environmental forensics can be is a large and diverse topic, much of which is beyond the scope of the guidance. The guidance focuses on the intersection shown in this Venn diagram, where background, risk assessment, and organic compounds meet environmental forensics techniques. And while it is true that environmental forensics can be applied and is applied to inorganic compounds involving metals, the guidance focuses on organic applications. For background and risk assessment purposes, environmental forensics is generally applied to groups of chemical compounds that are broadly similar in structure but have subtle differences that result in different chemical properties and source characteristics. Common examples of these are PAHs, PCBs, dioxins, and furans. With the exception of PAHs resulting from wildfires, these typically come into play when looking at anthropogenic rather than natural background. Considering background for these chemicals can be important because they are widespread and persistent in the environment. Environmental forensics is both a science and an art. There is no single magic bullet. No two data sets are the same. No two sites are the same. And as such, its application requires a strong chemistry background and should be conducted by someone with experience and expertise in the field. As presented in the guidance, these techniques generally serve as a line of evidence rather than a definitive smoking gun regarding background versus site-related sources. Environmental forensics is primarily covered in Chapter 7 of the guidance. As you can see from this outline, the chapter is broken into sections corresponding to the different organic groups of compounds. The primary focus is on PAHs. Note that both TPH and PFAS have their own ITRC guidance documents. Additional environmental forensics resources are provided in the case study chapter. Specifically, look at section 14.7, which is a PAH example. And also, Appendix C contains approximately 50 references on environmental forensics involving PAHs. So in the rest of this presentation, I'm going to focus on PAHs because of the chemical groups covered in the guidance. These are probably the ones most familiar to most risk assessors' experience. They have high toxicity, relatively low screening levels, and are abundant above risk-based criteria, especially in urban areas, and thus are frequently risk drivers. From a human health risk assessment perspective, we are generally most concerned with the high molecular weight, benzoapyrene equivalent carcinogenic PAHs, often the risk drivers. But the same general approach and thought process, starting with the chemistry of the compounds, would apply to forensics involving the other chemical groups that I mentioned. So I think of three different scenarios at a site. Again, focusing on PAHs. PAH concentrations in soil can be below risk-based screening criteria. If so, that's interesting, but there's no problem, and you're not doing environmental forensics, probably. Secondly, you can have a situation where you have a general haze at your site where there's no clear source, but PAHs do exceed or straddle risk-based criteria. For example, in this diagram, a site which you have the white boxes only. It's possible that this situation can be evaluated by a background study, either a regional one or a study focused on adjacent sites, without delving into forensics. However, forensics may come in handy as the PAH fingerprint may or may not be consistent with expectations for regional or anthropogenic background or with the site history or sources. The most challenging situation is one where the presence of a site-related source is clear. There may be hotspots that clearly exceed risk criteria, but where there is also a general low-level haze of PAHs. How much of that haze is site-related? How much is regional background? These are questions with real risk assessment and remedy considerations, and where environmental forensics has an important role to play. I should note that PAHs are also produced naturally in wildfires, and so the potential for background contributions to PAHs is not strictly limited to urban areas. The guidance presents four basic approaches to forensic analysis for PAHs, and refers to them as the four forms of forensic analyses. These are essentially visualization techniques, some of which require specialized laboratory analyses and/or statistical evaluation. And these forms include use of diagnostic ratios, pattern recognition, spatial or temporal analysis, and quantitative source apportionment techniques such as principal component analysis, chemical mass balance, or positive matrix factorization, so PCA, CMB, PMF. Again, the guidance mentions each of these in section 7.1 and provides a good access to the literature through references in Appendix C. Before going into these forms, I need to introduce some basic PAH chemistry and some key general concepts about PAH sources. First of all, PAHs are polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and they contain more than one benzene ring structure connected by sharing of one side of a benzene ring. The simplest of these would be naphthalene with two rings, anthracene with three rings. The most important grouping of PAHs for the purpose of forensics, as well as risk, is the distinction between low molecular weight PAHs with two or three rings and high molecular weight PAHs with four or more rings shown in this slide. From a risk perspective, benzoylpyrene equivalent PAHs with four or more rings and structures and toxicity similar to benzoylpyrene are the most important and frequently drive human health risks at petroleum sites. However, from a forensic perspective, the low molecular weight PAHs are also important. As risk assessors, we sometimes get focused on benzoylpyrene equivalents, but we shouldn't lose sight of the other PAHs, even if they don't drive risk. For example, anthracene shown here is typically not a human health risk driver, but can be important for forensics. A second consideration is the relative stability of isomers. Here are three pairs of isomers, that is, chemical compounds with the same molecular formula and slightly different molecular structures. Due to their structural similarities, they have similar environmental fates, but potentially different sources. The third consideration is that PAHs have alkyl groups in place of hydrogen attached to the aromatic rings. These also can provide a clue as to the PAH source. If a lab is instructed to include alkyl PAHs in its 8270 analysis, they will report the alkyl homolog groups as well as the parent PAHs without the alkyl groups. So shown here are two C1 naphthalenes, that is 1-methyl and 2-methyl naphthalene, each with one methyl group. Combined, they would form the C1 naphthalene homolog group identified in the table by the pink arrow. As you can see, there are C2, C3, C4 homolog groups with 2, 3, and 4 alkyl carbons respectively for several of the PAHs in the list. These alkyl groups can be used as a diagnostic tool in pattern recognition. And now a word about sources. PAHs are ubiquitous in soils worldwide. Once introduced into the environment, they are relatively stable and can be transported long distances. We've seen that slide before. PAHs are produced both naturally and anthropogenically. Their sources are very broadly categorized as biogenic, that is degradation of plant material, petrogenic, associated with crude oil formation, and pyrogenic, produced through incomplete combustion of, for example, wood, petroleum, or coal. Pyrogenic pHs contribute to soot and particulates and tend to dominate anthropogenic background in urban areas. And a complicating factor which needs to be considered is that weathering also affects the relative pH concentrations. Now let's look at the first of the four forms of pH forensics, the use of diagnostic ratios. Here we see four isomer pairs, which are commonly used to distinguish between sources, along with a table showing general rules of thumb for how those ratios reflect potential source types. A common way to look at these is to calculate the ratio of the isomer that is relatively less abundant in a petrogenic source, that is the ones on the left side of the stacking here, over the total. Therefore, as a general rule, low ratios tend towards petrogenic sources, higher ratios towards pyrogenic sources. Often, ratios are displayed on two-dimensional plots, such as the one shown here. This study of parks in Milwaukee is described in section 3 of the guidance, 3.2 of the guidance. It was used to identify urban background concentration of PAHs in the Milwaukee area, and the diagnostic ratios and the similarity of them, that is the blue cloud in the middle, were used as a line of evidence regarding background. A word of caution, that these diagnostic ratios are rules of thumb and often best viewed in the context of your site rather than as strict ranges. In the literature, the limits are not always exactly the same, though they follow the same general trend. The general differences in ratios between groups of data are as important as the absolute values. You also need to pay attention to analytical effects, especially at low concentrations. And of course, the effects of processes associated with weathering also impact these ratios. References included in the guidance can assist with evaluating the impact of weathering. So moving from the diagnostic ratios of parent pHs, we now step up a level in complexity to look at pattern recognition. First of all, the alkyl groups provide an important piece of information in these patterns, and thus the importance of including them in your analyses. In this example, parent pHs are shown on these graphs in dark blue and are arranged by molecular weight with the alkyl homolog groups adjacent to their parent and shown in light blue. So for example, right here we have N0, which is naphthalene, and adjacent to it we have N1, N2, and N3, are the homolog groups with 1, 2, and 3 total alkyl carbons. And similarly, other alkyl groups are shown for the other pHs. I've also drawn a line separating the low molecular weight pHs from the high molecular weight pHs. The figure presents pH patterns for road asphalt and urban dust. Important things to look at in this pattern display are the relative abundance of low and high molecular weight pHs, that is the dark blue bars on the left and right side of the dotted line, and the pattern of alkyl homolog groups highlighted in the red and green circles. Urban dust has a relatively high abundance of the high molecular weight pHs and shows a skewed pattern in the alkyl groups, that is the ski slope look in the red circles. In contrast, road asphalt shows similar concentrations of high and low molecular weight pHs, higher concentrations of the alkyl groups, and a hump shape in the alkyl groups as shown in the green circles. So here's the interpretation of this specific example. The urban dust pattern is characteristic of combustion-derived anthropogenic ambient background, predominantly heavy pHs and skewed alkyl groups. This pyrogenic combustion signature is often characteristic of background pH signatures in urban areas. This is distinguished from a characteristic petroleum signature of the asphalt, which has a lower relative abundance of the heavy pHs and the hump signature for the alkyl groups. So those are the first two forms. The third form of forensic analysis for pHs is spatial and temporal analysis. Simply put, Spatial and temporal analysis involves evaluating the chemical data from the site in detail, looking for vertical and lateral extent of PAHs, changes in their chemistry or relative ratios from hotspots to outlying areas, considering the historical uses of the site. The case study in section 14.7 is a good example of pulling together historical site use information with the PAH and petroleum chemistry. Finally, the guidance touches on quantitative source apportionment techniques, focusing on principal component analysis, or PCA, which is the most commonly used. PCA is a mathematical method that transforms a large number of possibly correlated variables, such as concentrations, into a smaller number of uncorrelated variables referred to as principal components. Those components are ranked by the amount of variance in the data that they explain and are displayed in factor score plots, which I'll show on the next slide. Factor scores that plot close to one another share similar compositions. Factor scores that plot far apart have different compositions. And so I'll close with this example, which is described in the guidance. The diagram shows both PAH patterns over here and a graph of PCA factor score here for 350 sediment samples from a site. In this case, the patterns show parent PAHs only without alkyl groups. Pattern A, identified with the red circle on both the pattern plot and the PCA factor score plot, represents a moderately weathered creosote and is characterized by relatively abundant, low molecular weight PAHs, the gray bars. Pattern B is a more severely weathered creosote showing loss of the lightest PAHs, the gray bars on the left, and relatively higher abundance of the high molecular weight PAHs, that is the black bars to the right. Pattern C is consistent with combustion-sourced urban background. The PCA factor score plot shows that most samples appear as mixtures of the weathered creosote and urban anthropogenic ambient background. These two different contributing sources could be quantitatively apportioned. Okay, time for the last poll question. Compared to a petrogenic signature, a pyrogenic signature is typically characterized by which of the following? A, B, C, or D? And Devin, I'll let you decide when time's up.
I'm going to give it about 30 seconds here, Charlie, and then I'll close the poll.
Great. Okay, so we've got most people said D, and that is the correct answer. And I guess the point of asking this question was maybe not so much all of the above, but any of the above, that these are all different ways, different visualization techniques, analytical and visualization techniques that can be used to distinguish between pyrogenic and petrogenic signatures. So thank you. And with that, I guess I pass it back to Devin. I think we're open for questions.
Yes. All right. So let's see here. Thank you, Charlie. As he said, we are going to start our first and only question and answer portion for the training here today. So I did drop something in the chat for everybody, but if you have any questions for our trainers, please put those in the Q&A pod and we will, our trainers will be able to address them live. So with that, I'm going to start with a few that were put in earlier and our trainers already typed responses to, but we want to just reiterate it for the full group. So Brady, would you mind explaining USLs, UTLs, UCLs, and UPLs in layman's terms, please?
Sure. This is a little bit difficult at times to explain because these all have a statistical their school definition, but
hey, Brady, it kind of sounds like your audio is going in and out a bit. Maybe if you want to turn your video off, that may help.
Is that any better?
A little bit, not too much better. If you want, we can go to another question and come back to that if you need to adjust your mic or anything.
Yeah, that'd be good.
All right. All right. So, Bonnie, can you talk about someone put in the chat that they work for an agency that deals with wildfires, and they were wondering if we could touch on how wildfires affects PAH in the soil a bit more, and if you have any recommendations in terms of where they could find more information on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to call on Charlie to give us more information if you can do that, Charlie. But we do include natural, like PAHs from wildfires in our definition of natural background. We do include that. We don't include that in anthropogenic ambient because that is obviously from a natural source, also volcanoes and anything like that that's natural. But Charlie, where I'm going to call on you to answer is because you are the expert on environmental forensics, and I definitely am not. And so there's probably a way to tease that out. And I'm not so sure if maybe some of the, I don't think we handle that in the actual guidance, but you provided so many references and the other people that worked on that section. So there might be some reference or some additional information that you might have that you could share.
Right. So with respect to the guidance, I don't know that there is specific references that address that issue. There are references in the literature on it. There's actually a fairly a fair number. And you know, my experience in this has been, I do a lot of work in the Western United States, and so we have plenty of opportunity to evaluate for wildfires. And so it's really been to look at areas that have been affected by fire and compare, you know, empirical basically has been the bulk of my experience. So I'm not that sure if that's helpful, but.
All right. Thank you, Bonnie and Charlie. So with that, I'm going to look perhaps back to Brady to see if he is able to give us more of an explanation of those terms in of those USLs, UTLs, UCLs, and UPLs in layman's terms. Brady, do you want to check if your audio is a bit better now?
How does it sound now?
Sounds good.
Okay. Apologies for that. The difference between those different background threshold values, typically when we reference a UCL, by default, we typically talk about the UCL of a mean, although it doesn't necessarily have to be that. But that's taking a statistical parameter like the mean, and then we're putting some sort of uncertainty with the prediction of that on there. So the reason that we really say that, you know, you can't really compare the UCL of a mean to a upper prediction limit or upper tolerance limit or upper simultaneous limit is those are defining a population and a certain percentage of the population. Like say, this is going to contain 90% of the population. Or you think back to when you were taking a their SAT and you were in the, you know, everybody here was in the, you know, upper 1% of it. So that's looking at that kind of population. So the upper confidence limit on the mean, looking at an average type value as to where the upper prediction limit, tolerance limit, and simultaneous limits, those both have some sort of percentage component where we're looking at, say, the upper or trying to constrain 90% of the data, but then putting on an uncertainty to it. The kind of simple differences between those, the prediction limits are set for a set number of future samples. So those values are typically smaller because they're only meant to contain, say, the next 5 samples that you take. An upper tolerance limit is a confidence limit on a percentile, but that's meant to encompass all of your future samples. So typically a little bit higher than a prediction limit. And an upper simultaneous limit's a little bit of a newer type of statistic, but that's really meant to contain all future samples and have every potential sample that you would take be below that, as to where your tolerance limits are. It's only trying to say, like, a, you know, 95% of your data or your population, as to where simultaneous limits should include all of them. So that's kind of a brief rundown on that. We do have a description in that in section 11. We had made reference to ProUCL as a statistical program to do that. They have both a user guidance and a technical guidance that goes through all of those possible BTVs too.
So just going along that same thread, can you use ISM data as BTVs, or more generally, is incremental sampling an appropriate methodology to use to establish soil background?
Yeah, so ISM is a interesting sampling method. And I will say section 9 of our guidance, we discuss sampling methods. We discuss discrete samples, which, you know, is our individual kind of like our grab soil sample, composite samples where we would be, you know, possibly mixing different samples together to get more of an average concentration that can be spatially or with depth too, if we have a, you know, surface and then a little bit of a deeper sample, we can kind of have that depth averaged. But then for those who aren't, ISM is a very structured and very well-defined method that works to really get an average value that we'd be looking at. So incremental sampling reduces data variability in there. So you get typically you get like a better estimate of the mean, but you do that while losing some of your greater population parameters. So you kind of lose out on that upper tail. It is a bit of a newer method, so some agencies don't always accept that. But I mean, the important thing to remember for all of this is that the ISM data represent a physical average. So again, kind of going back to that BTV, if we're looking at, you know, an upper tolerance limit, those are for as a comparison to individual samples, to individual future samples, as to where if you had a ISM sample, that's a representation of a mean value. So those kind of comparisons between UTLs and your average grand mean, I believe is what it's called with ISM, those comparisons are just two different statistical parameters. So not really comparable.
All right. Thank you, Brady. We have a question in the chat. You stated that the USL is not appropriate for BTVs. This is inconsistent with EPA's guidance in the ProUCL documentation. There are specific statistical properties of the data set that would dictate whether a USL is an appropriate UL to use, single population and no outliers, for example. Please discuss why USLs should not be used for default BTVs. I believe, Bonnie, you had a response to that one. I'm just going to punt that right to you.
Yeah, sure. And I don't know, Chrissy, if you want to say anything either, because this was your section that you went over, but I don't think that we were implying that you can never use USLs. We were implying that it's generally not a good choice to use USLs. I personally don't feel like it's ever a good choice to use USLs on anything I've ever worked on. But that doesn't mean I couldn't work on something in the future that I might, for some reason, think that the USL was the best choice. Typically for default values, working for a regulatory agency, we look for something that's going to be protective. It's going to be protective of, you know, like hundreds of sites. Usually there are a bunch of brownfield sites and other Superfund sites maybe that are going to be compared to this value. So we want to make sure that we're being protective and that USL is not going to be protective in that kind of situation. So that's what we were trying to get at with the guidance and the presentation, is that the USL is normally not going to be your best choice for a default BTV. But there may be times when that USL may be appropriate. But again, if you're going to use a USL because you think it is appropriate, you need to definitely make sure that you are using the maximum site concentration to compare to that, because that's an upper end estimate on the maximum. And so that's why it's not going to be protective. And that's why you need to use the maximum to compare to it.
Bonnie, may I just add, in the guidance, section 3.8 lists the various potential background threshold values that can be used for default or site-specific cell background, and USL is listed as one of the options. So the guidance does not say you can't use it, just to want to make that clear. And it also goes on to say in section, later in a section 3.9, that there is no consensus about the use of an upper limit to use. So in addition to everything you just said.
Yeah, but it does, go ahead, Chrissy.
Sorry, I just wanted to add just also that you just, you know, definitely want to have someone that, you know, understands the different nuances of the different statistical values, because one thing with the upper simultaneous limit is that it is sensitive to outliers. So it is recommended that it's only used with background data sets that are devoid of outliers. So just there's some caution in the guidance, like pros and cons.
Devoid of true outliers, as true. In outlier concentrations that were determined statistically and then later evaluated, mm-hmm. shown to be unrepresentative of background, because statistical outlier tests can tell you if a concentration is high, but it can't tell you why. So that's why you do need it to confirm if your outlier really is unrepresentative of background. And if it is representative of background, it should be retained.
Yes, absolutely. Again, why I think
follow-on discussion about outliers.
I think it's also important just to talk about, we recommend the UTL. And the reason is because that UTL is going to be protective in those cases where you're doing a default BTV for like hundreds, probably thousands. It just depends on whether your state has a statewide BTV or a regional BTV. But you're going to have a great number of sites compared to that. And you want to make sure that you're going to be conservative enough. And the RP, the VP, the voluntary party, the responsible party, always has the option to go a step further and do a site-specific risk assessment, come up with a site-specific BTB, site-specific data set, use geochemical evaluations, environmental forensics. Those default BTBs are like these quick things that regulatory agencies need, so they can screen a great volume of sites against them. So they need to be conservative enough.
And I would add to that, that we can go out, spend a lot of money, collect the most amazing background data set on the planet, and calculate the most rigorous and appropriate background threshold value, and everything's great, and still have site concentrations that are naturally elevated that exceed our awesome background threshold value. But that's okay, because at that point, we go ahead and we do a geochemical evaluation or environmental forensics to determine the reason for the elevated concentration. So we can, no matter what statistics you do, there's gonna be a concentration that exceeds your concentration, or in a two sample test, you'll fail a test for perhaps natural reasons, but that can all be determined.
Yep, and you need to take all the site information. Mm-hmm. You know, like Karen was talking about outliers, you need to take everything into consideration. You just don't go. Yeah.
It's not just a magic number.
Exactly. It's not a magic number at all.
It's a useful starting point.
Yep. And one of the reasons why we recommend the point by point is so that you can see, do you have one exceedance in 100? Do you have 99 exceedances in 100? I mean, all of those things tell a story about the site.
Right. Exactly. Good question. That prompted a good, a lively discussion here. Thank you for that question.
All right. Thank you, Karen, Christy, and Bonnie. I'm going to move right to the next question. We have a few in here that I want to get to before the end of the training today. So regarding geochemical evaluations, chromium is ubiquitous in soil, in the soils I deal with. Usually chromium, I just like to say that I am not scientifically inept or adept. So usually chromium, but some CR.
Hexavalent chromium.
Yeah, thank you, Karen. From geological sources and or more widespread urban anthropogenic sources. Curious to know the best approach to determine whether chromium six is site related, since chromium six screening levels are fairly low.
Yes, and chromium six risk-based screening levels are very low because hexavalent chromium is so toxic, mutagenic, carcinogenic, teratogenic, and so on. And yes, chromium is ubiquitous, and typically it is present in most soils as trivalent chromium, which is not much less toxic. And one way, if you're just dealing with so-called total chromium analyses, which most of us usually are at our sites, and chromium is a funny animal. Chromium, trivalent chromium species can adsorb on clays and iron oxides, depending upon pH, which is very localized, highly site-specific and soil-specific to your sample even. So look for correlations between chromium and aluminum, chromium and iron. Trivalent chromium has strong affinities to adsorb on clays and iron oxides. Hexavalent chromium has very low adsorption affinity, so we don't expect to see any covariance between hexavalent chromium and aluminum, iron, manganese, and so on. Whereas we do expect to see that with trivalent chromium. So if you see a lot of scatter on your plot, that could indicate one of two things. You've got trivalent chromium contamination, which is possible, or you have hexavalent chromium. If you're really stuck and need to go further, then I would go ahead and speciate, have your lab speciate the analyses and obtain trivalent and hexavalent analyses for your soil samples. That would give you the answer you need right away. But if you see a correlation between chromium and aluminum, then that indicates trivalent chromium.
All right. Thank you, Karen. And thank you for the help with reading that question out.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. Is there a background concentration for PFAS?
So I'll take this one. I am not aware of background concentrations for PFAS. We didn't address PFAS in any detail in our guidance document. It's really an evolving, as everyone knows, evolving field. It's evolving very rapidly. ITRC has a special PFAS group, developed a PFAS guidance that would be more focused on this. I will say from a forensics point of view, because PFAS, you know, is a group of compounds that can have a large number of other functional groups, chemical functional groups on it. The forensics would be really interesting, but far more complex than for PAHs. So that's, we didn't focus on it. It was outside the scope for us, but check out the ITRC PFAS guidance.
All right, thank you, Charlie. Next question. Are there any recommendations for handling a background data set that is so large that it tightens the variability to the point that several of the upper end values in the background data set itself are above all of the potential BTVs?
Did somebody else want to speak, Charlie? I was just going to briefly say that with any, like, for example, a 95% upper tolerance limit, you do expect at least, under best conditions, at least 5% of uncontaminated site concentrations to exceed that 95th UTL. So it's going to happen. I don't know if Charlie or someone else wanted to jump on top of that answer.
No, I was going to say the same thing.
But again, that's okay as long as you can evaluate the data geochemically, Brady. Right.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I mean, especially with the tolerance limits, because you have both the, you know, confidence, which is the uncertainty, but then with that, you have a certain amount of coverage. You have that percentile. So, you know, we often talk about 95-95, but you can also look at a different, you know, percentile if you're trying to be extra conservative. And again, just as Karen said, there's the expectation that not all of them would be within that. And particularly if you get into non-parametric statistics, you know, there's going to be a number to where if you have over, you know, X number of samples to where you would be exceeding it with that threshold. So certainly a consideration that you'd have to have. And I think a lot of that is why, you know, USLs have kind of been creeping into discussion. But again, it is expected and means your statistics are working well.
All right. Thank you, Brady and Karen. Okay. So how many background, or excuse me, so per slide 35, what if you do not have a large number of comparisons, can a BTV be obtained? And I can go back to slide 35.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to ask you to do that.
One moment here.
And just looking at the question, this is Karen, just looking at the question, when I see a large number of comparisons, to me, I'm inferring that the question means do not have a large number of comparisons. In other words, a small number of site samples. Yes, you can still use the background threshold value. Now, if you're talking about a small background data set, yes, you can still calculate a BTV. And I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question.
I would think, I don't understand the question either, but if you're talking about if you have a small data set, can you calculate a BTV? Uh-huh. You can't necessarily say yes. I mean, you have to see what that data set looks like and how small it is. Like
if it's five.
I have seen where some people will try to do that based on like do statistics on three samples. And that is not recommended. What's recommended by EPA is to have like 10 samples in their pro-UCL guidance, something like 8 to 10 or something like that.
Pro-UCL typically suggests 8 to 10 for a lot of the parameters that it calculates. And there's some old US EPA guidance that kind of throws out 10 as kind of a convenient magic number. The fewer the background samples you have, the greater the uncertainty surrounding any parameter you calculate.
Yeah, I would just kind of caution anyone, if they are asking that question, talk to a statistician, talk to somebody who has some experience with this, because it really depends on so many things. It depends on how you designed your samples, how you took your samples. Are they of the same depth? Are they of the same sampling method, same analytical? I mean, there's just so many things. That's such an open-ended question. And especially somebody coming from a regulatory agency that developed background threshold values, I think you should reference the guidance. And if you have a more specific question, definitely follow up with us. But you definitely want to have a robust data set, and you want that data set to be representative of what you're trying to get, what your intention is. If you want to get natural backgrounds, you need to make sure you're sampling in areas that are going to represent natural background at the same depth, at the same analytical method, or rather using the same analytical method that the sites that you're going to evaluate against used, and so on and so on. There's so much to say, I'm going to stop because I could go on for a long time, and it looks like we might have time for another question.
So we actually, those are all the questions that we have. And I do want to just be cognizant of everybody's time today. And as the training's only going till 3, I am going to wrap up here. So let me go back to our final slide here for everybody. And then we will wrap up the training and everybody will be off on their day.
Can I just say one more thing, Devin?
Of course. Yes.
If you didn't get your question answered, if you had a question, then definitely don't hesitate to let us know, one of us on the team, and we can answer that.
All right. So thank you, everybody, trainers and attendees, for joining us today and for submitting all those wonderful questions. I would like to remind everybody that we do have a feedback form available, and that is also how you would obtain a certificate of completion for today's course. It is available through the Clumen training page that brought you here. And when you leave the Zoom, when the Zoom meeting ends, it should prompt you to follow a link to that Clumen training page to complete that form as well. So as Bonnie said, if you have any further questions or would like any clarifications to any questions asked today or any answers provided, feel free to follow up with us at training@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Their information is on the Clumen training page that brought you here today as well. And I would also just like to remind everybody that ITRC does archive all of its trainings. So if you have any additional time or are interested in any different training opportunities, please visit the Clumen website and their archived trainings page to see all the courses that are available to you. So I did put the link to the SBR guidance document and training videos in the chat here, and would just like to thank everybody again for joining us, and a special thank you to our trainers. And with that, I'll wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and we will end the training here. All right. Thank you, trainers.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for attending.
Thank you, everybody.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Devin.
Thanks, everybody.